Good morning. Now, it's very human and natural to seek solace in a dangerous and unpredictable world, particularly so in times like now, where two wars are happening simultaneously, either one having a good possibility of spreading and sucking in the rest of the world. And politically, we're facing a showdown in the U.S., between what you would call forces of reason and moderation and forces of ignorance, violence, hatred, political extremism, never-ending propaganda. Looking into the not-too-distant future is like looking down into a deep, dark well. All that is foreground, the current scenery, if you will, of the news and events in the world. But we also know that life is short. The body is vulnerable. Health is fragile. Death is the end outcome of every living thing that has ever or ever will appear on Earth. This is the background, the underlying fact of existence. As the Buddha said on his deathbed to his monks, all component things are subject to decay. This may have been the first utterance of what we call the second law of thermodynamics, entropy. Everything is falling apart. As human beings, we want some kind of stability, peace of mind, insurance against disaster. We accumulate things, money, relationships, affiliations, all that. We try to forget through distractions, to numb through substances and addictions to this or that. We also make up stories in our minds of an afterlife, a God watching out for us, a heaven to which we're going after death. I'm not saying these things are falsehoods, only that there's no real evidence for any of it. It's not something to hang your hat on, to stake all your bets on. It's like playing roulette and putting all your chips on double zero when there is no double zero on the wheel. We're just hoping magically double zero will appear when we throw the ball. Religions, for the most part, push these stories, this magical thinking, on people who are desperate for protection, for certainty, for permanence. They create a sense of belonging to a tribe while at the same time rejecting beliefs that run counter to their stories, because their stories are based on a flimsy foundation. And this leads to hatred and violence, as we all know. What does Buddhism, Zen, offer someone not wanting magical promises, who just wants to see things more clearly, be less attached, be more okay with uncertainty? I think the key difference between God-based religions and the non-theistic viewpoint of Zen and Buddhism in general is that what is solid, true, dependable, and all-embracing is already in our possession, permeates all of reality, can't be attained because it can't be lost. It's our true nature as sentient living beings. And it's the one thing we can truly rely on, but only if we can see it clearly and know it from the inside, not just as a belief or a story. There's no one and nothing to pray to, nowhere to go and get it, no person or teacher or even deity that can awaken us to this thing on our behalf without our full commitment and involvement. So this solace, this reality, goes by various names. True nature, Buddha nature, it with a capital I. Probably the tersest way of naming it. The source, nothingness, suchness, etc., etc. As practitioners of Zen, of mindfulness, we are always on the lookout, always paying attention, always doubting our thinking and conclusions. As the Zen master Jizo said to the monk Hogen, not knowing is most intimate. We push ourselves into this not knowing place so that conceptual thinking can't block this it that is always with us. A Zen master, Suzaki Roshi, put it this way when I was a student of his. He said, often, God is always with you. Your true nature is always with you. I took this on faith at the time. He also more cryptically told me, your true nature has no color, no sound, no taste, no touch, no smell, no thoughts. And it has color, sound, taste, touch, smell, and thoughts. This was absolutely mystifying to me at the time. So this true nature, this source, this it, I have it right now. No, I am it. I am shining it right now. But what is it? How can it be both colorless and colorful? What kind of thing is this? One day, I was taking an afternoon walk during a sesshin, and it was after a particularly intense period of concentration. And walking along, it was summertime, I was watching intently the pavement passing under my feet, and I abruptly caught it that the being of the pavement, that is, its reality, was precisely my knowing it. Being and knowing were one substance, if you will. The substance shined from each and everything, the grass at the side of the road, the headstones in the cemetery just past the wooden fence, the fence itself. This substance was kind of an amalgam. It was the utter non-separation of my mind and objects. I had perceived this in various ways before, but right then it was crystal clear and had no doubt about it. It was the, quote, most intimate of Jizo's not knowing. If knowing and being are one substance, one it, knowing and not knowing are the same thing, because there's no subject standing apart. Now, it's comforting to believe that this substance is waiting for us when the end comes, a kind of Buddhist heaven, if you will. But we have no evidence of that. As practitioners, we must live in the present and not make up stories about the future, even if they're Buddhist stories. When I was in college about 20 years ago, at about age 20, and I started reading an assigned book, The Three Pillars of Zen, I had already had some experience with meditation, I was struck by comments made by Yasutani Roshi to students attending an introductory lecture on Zen practice. This was in the beginning few chapters of the book. And I remember he said something like, if an atomic or hydrogen bomb exploded above you, what would you do? So let me actually read this from the book. So he, in this lecture, said, what we call life is no more than a procession of transformations. If we do not change, we are lifeless. We grow and age because we are alive. The evidence of having lived is the fact that we die. We die because we are alive. Living means birth and death. Creation and destruction signify life. When you truly understand this fundamental principle, you will not be anxious about your life or your death. You will then attain a steadfast mind and be happy in your daily life. Even though heaven and earth were turned upside down, you would have no fear. And if an atomic or hydrogen bomb were exploded, you would not quake in terror. So long as you became one with the bomb, what would there be to fear? Impossible, you say. But whether you wanted to or not, you would perforce become one with it, would you not? I remembered that word, perforce. You would perforce become one with it, would you not? By the same token, if you were caught in a holocaust, inevitably you would be burnt. Therefore, become one with the fire when there's no escaping it. He goes on, but that's kind of the essence of the point he was making. So about 15 years after I read that book for the course, I was now a doctor working in an ER, and I met this patient, and she was a 70-year-old woman, very thin, youthful looking. She had a calm demeanor and kind, bright eyes. I remember she was neatly dressed in a nice one-piece blue dress. She was Japanese, and she spoke perfect English with a Japanese accent. And I had studied Japanese in college. I took Japanese for a year and had practiced Zen intently since that time, and I was very fascinated with Japan. She came in for some rather minor problem. It was a cough or something. She told me that she had been living locally and had been in the U.S. most of her life. And I asked her, where in Japan were you from? And she told me, Hiroshima. I said to her, you must have been really lucky to have left before the bomb was dropped. No, she told me. I was about 1.5 miles from ground zero. I was standing outside my building where I was working as a secretary. I was just 20 years old. I was standing next to a tall, thick concrete wall. And I remember picturing this in my head at the time. Then there was a blinding flash, and when it was over, everywhere I looked, everyone was dead. She had never told anyone her story, and she refused to take my offer. I encouraged her strongly to find some media outlet, some newspaper, to be interviewed and tell her story before the story was lost forever. She had no interest in this at all, but she did tell me to be certain to visit Hiroshima someday. It was totally rebuilt, very beautiful. And she added, they love Americans. Now this substance, this it, this true nature, is melted into the world of forms. It doesn't stand apart. Therefore, it isn't some kind of knower. It is the shining of reality itself. Whatever happens, it's there. It's automatically adapted, not resisting, not holding back. Just one with each and every thing, because it is the very fact of each and every thing. When we're not engrossed in the particularities, this fact is shining very simply, silently. This fact has no particular color, no particular sound, etc. But every color and sound is shining this fact, this it. Of course, as Zen practitioners, we want to believe that this reality is a final resting place that remains when the world is gone, and we somehow go there and rest there. It would be the Buddhist notion of heaven, I suppose. So I want to read a koan that deals directly with this. From the Hekigan Roku, it's case 29. Dai Zuiz, it will be gone with the other. So let me find this case. The case is short. It's preceded by an introduction by Engo, who was the compiler. I'm reading this now from Sekida's Two Zen Classics, the Mumonkan and the Hekigan Roku. So that once again, this is case 29 in the Hekigan Roku. And Engo's introduction to this case, it will be gone with the other, goes like this. Fish swimming, the waters disturbed. A bird flying, a feather falls. Host and guest are clearly distinguished. Black and white are sharply divided. It is like a clear mirror on the stand and a bright jewel in the hand. When a man of Han appears, he is reflected. If a man of Ho comes, he is mirrored. Sound is manifest. Color is apparent. How will it be like that? So he's asking here, how is it that a man of Han is reflected? You might say, is reflection. A man of Ho comes, he is mirrored. He is the mirroring of this man of Ho. There's one thing. Sound is manifest, just. Color is apparent, just. So the main subject goes like this. A monk asked Dai Zui, when the kalpa fire flares up and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, will it perish or will it not perish? Dai Zui said, it will perish. The monk said, then will it be gone with the other? Dai Zui said, it will be gone with the other. And Secho, the other compiler of the Hekigan Roku, wrote a verse. Blocked by the double barrier, the monk asks from the heart of the kalpa fire. Wonderful the words, it will be gone with the other. Thousands of miles he wandered in vain seeking a master. And this alludes to a story following this koan in the main book of the Hekigan Roku, where this monk, after this encounter with Dai Zui, walked a long distance along the Yangtze River to the south and met with another master and told him the story, apparently hoping this other master would say something like, oh, Dai Zui doesn't know what he's talking about. Of course, it will remain after the end of the kalpa ending fire. But this Zen master said, Dai Zui is a brilliant master. What he told you is the truth. You should probably have never left him. And Dai Zui then rushed back up along the Yangtze River to the north, went to the hermitage where he'd met Dai Zui. But Dai Zui had already died. So, how would you demonstrate this gone with the other, this not standing apart, this no magical thinking? How would you demonstrate that from the words, the events in the case? Remember Yasutani's words. Therefore, become one with fire when there's no escaping it. Now let's just start with everyday things, events, problems, challenges in our lives. That's enough for now, and it's perfect training for the kalpa-ending fire billions of years from now. Okay, so we'll end there.